My big aha moment was really realizing that, you know, a lot of times we focus on the limited English, right? But also not looking at, a lot of them come with the home language and they're really bilingual students. So really celebrating the fact that, you know, we are dealing with kids that are bilingual, and to be able to nurture that and to really educate ourselves on that bilingual development.
This is Enriching Education, the show for educators and evaluators who are striving to enrich the lives of each unique student. Brought to you by Riverside Insights. Celebrating diverse cultures in and out of the classroom has become a staple of everyday life in America. But being bilingual presents its own challenges in the world of student assessment. Today, we are thrilled to welcome Dr. Pedro Olvera, Clinical Director at Dr. Olvera Psychology, Associate Professor at Cal Baptist University, an expert in bilingual therapy and psychology, to the show. In his conversation with Dr. Tammy Stevens, Dr. Olvera shares how evaluators can move beyond test scores to more nuanced understanding of our increasingly diverse student population. He shares the vital role of language and academics in the challenge bilingual learners face, especially with the loss of practice and social interaction due to COVID-19. As we confront the shifting landscape of education, understanding the intricacies of bilingual assessments help foster more inclusive and effective educational practice.
Thanks for joining us today on the podcast. We're going to be talking about diversity in testing, and we're really excited to have Dr. Pedro Olvera here today to talk with us about that topic. And just wanted to say thank you for being here. And I'm going to just kind of dive right in, if it's okay with you, Dr. Olvera.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm really excited. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
So I was doing a little research prior to this podcast recording. And one of the things that I was finding was that the number of diverse students has increased across the United States over the past decade. And, you know, there's different numbers out there with regards to percentages of increase, et cetera. But one of the stats that I read stated that by 2025, experts predict that diverse students will make up the majority of the U.S. high school graduates. So I was just kind of thinking about that and the impact that has on teachers, evaluators, as well as, you know, publishing companies that are creating these tests that we're using to assess these kiddos. Can we start off with you just talking about, from your experience and research, how do you define diverse students?
I think diverse students are, I mean, the way I define it are students that come from different backgrounds, right? I mean, think about what diversity means. It's defined very broadly. Everything from ethnicity, linguistic abilities, culture, you know, you look at the gender aspect of it, neurodiversity. So I think it's just encompassing a very broad spectrum of students. And I think it's the recognition that students come from different backgrounds. And within this different background, we as educators or school psychologists, you know, we really need to be aware of this diverse group of students, that they're all going to come from different experiences, that background knowledge that we talk a lot about. So it's really, I think, an awareness that not everyone's going to fit one mold, right? We're all bringing something very different to the table.
Right. And so when we have this conversation today, we're going to be talking about diversity in many different ways. So I think the first thing we're going to talk about is your bilingual students. So thinking about, you know, your own experience working as a bilingual psychologist, what are some of the challenges that you have faced with kids that you're working with?
Back when I started, I'd been a bilingual school psychologist for about 21 years now. I went into the profession thinking, okay, well, this is going to be pretty straightforward. I'm bilingual. The students that I was working with at the time in Southern California, that district had probably about 95% bilingual students. It's a good fit, a good match, right? Thinking that, hey, I speak the language, you know, so it should be pretty straightforward. But I think that a lot of challenges came up in the process, not only in terms of knowing the language, but just even testing students, you know, being able to gauge, am I assessing what they know? Am I assessing how they think, right? What do these results mean? How valid are these results for the students I'm working with? understanding that bilingualism is a spectrum. It's not either or. Students came in with, maybe some of our students may have come in with an academic background in their primary language, and now they're being educated in English in their second language academically. Some were just social, right? Maybe they came from a home where the parents had a social language, not necessarily an academic background. Some kids came from homes where one parent spoke L1, the other one spoke English. So you have within the same home a bilingual background. So a lot of the challenges really gauged around, what am I assessing? What do these results mean? And how do I interpret these results in a way that's going to be valid and also fair for the student? And also really knowing the tools that were out there, that were available. When I heard about the Bateria Revise, that's back in those days, it was like, wow, this is groundbreaking here, because there's actually a tool here that at least brings that element into it, where some words that students were very familiar with as well. So really, I think those were the challenges. And how do we interpret all that within also their education? I mean, are they in a dual immersion, a bilingual program, English only, SEI? Are they doing pull-out ESL? There are so many different variables to consider that were challenging. And what did it mean at the assessment level?
Right. It sounds so complex. It's such a puzzle and a lot of variables, like you said, that you have to keep in mind. So as an evaluator and thinking about, we'll talk a little bit about test development and some of the things that publishers really keep in mind as they're developing these tests with regards to language, et cetera. But when you're talking about all those different variables that you have to consider for each of these students, I mean, like you said, one size doesn't fit all for these individuals. So how do you address that when you're conducting an assessment of a student, knowing that the norms of the tests that are out there may not adequately reflect the norms of the individual students that are sitting in front of you? What do you think as far as best practice when doing that?
I think that's the big piece. I think square one is understanding that there is no perfect test out there, right? That all of them will have strengths and limitations, not necessarily as a test itself, but with the population we're working with. I know that tests have come a long way. Every revision gets better. I think that awareness grows as well. So we understand that there's going to be limitations, right? But how do we navigate around those limitations and understand those limitations, I think, is important. We talk a lot about looking at that context of the student in terms of what educational experiences has the student had, because the test is going to give us information. And we all know that tests are valid. They're reliable. I mean, they're really, really well made now, right? I mean, they're very well made and they get better every time. So I don't necessarily see the test as being a problem in itself. It's now, what does it mean when you test a student? What does that number mean? You know, you look at the number, that number is the tip of the iceberg. There's a big context under that that we got to consider. So in looking at it from that standpoint, as Naglieri says, how the student thinks versus what the student knows, right? Is there a way to assess a student and sort of stay within that context of that processing? How does the student process information? Looking at the student's, again, educational experience. Have they been exposed to the test items? Looking at progress over time. So looking at classroom information, progress monitoring data. So we're trying to look at the whole picture rather than just the number, right? And running with that number.
And I think a lot of evaluators, just from my own experience and what I've seen, over rely on these scores, right? And they sometimes forget to look at everything else. So I think it's very important, like you say, that we look at everything, regardless of the child that we're looking at. We get a comprehensive view of that particular student. Thinking about the tests and continuing along that line, when test developers, publishers create these tests, they go through a series of standardization processes and et cetera. And one of those pieces include like bias reviews for language and for culture. This kind of touches on what you've already said, but I just wanted to kind of reiterate, how important are test bias reviews for publishers?
Yeah, I think they're very important, right? Because again, where does intelligence come from? How is it defined? And I know that there's a lot of science that goes behind it, and I understand that piece of it. And again, as we said before, they go under very rigorous reviews, test bias. We have experts looking at the information. There's a very, very thorough process that I have a lot of confidence in. But at the end of the day, when you think about intelligence, it's really a concept of culture, right? What's intelligence maybe in our culture? Maybe it's not necessarily how it's defined in another country or another environment. So there's that element that comes into play. So I do think that being very aware and cognizant, again, as I said earlier, that not everyone's coming to the table with the same background, the same experiences. I think that's very important. You know, I was talking to a student the other day, and we were thinking about the students that we work with. And you have students that are born into English-only homes, and that's the culture, that's the environment, that's the language. There's programs they watch, music they listen to. They go to school, they learn in English, they come back, they talk in English, they speak in English, they talk about their school day in English. You have other students that maybe they come from Spanish-speaking homes, and maybe they're in another country. They go to school in English, they hear music in English, they watch TV in English. And then you have those students that are coming from, say, an L1 home that's different. And then they are going to school in English, right? And now they're going back home and speaking L1 again and going back to school in English, watching different programs, different contexts. And that experience is going to be very different, right? So I think of myself, I spoke Spanish at home and I went to school in English, came back, spoke Spanish all day. So it wasn't like we were really processing. It was just the language was very different, you know? So we're talking about culture, values, beliefs, right? There's a lot that goes into culture. It's not all going to be the same, right? So I think being very aware of that, I think it's important, especially as we're looking at tests and interpreting tests, you know, is it a cultural thing or is it something else, right? So I think it's very important for us to be very aware of that piece of it. Although I know that tests are a lot better than they were maybe 50, 60 years ago, right? I mean, in California, we have Larry P in our face all the time. So we're constantly thinking about that. Tests have come a long way. Nevertheless, so with the increasing diversity, it's still, culture is very important, right? To consider always.
You know, publishers try to update the tests every 10 to 12 years for various reasons. And part of it is the fact that sometimes some of these items can become outdated and inadvertently become not a fair measure of students' abilities, et cetera. I know one example of a bias review, I remember, and I'm not going to mention the test, but there was an item where there was a picture of a farmhouse and it had, have you seen this? It had the front porch and it had high grass and it had paint chipping and then it had a couch on the front porch. And I think the question was something about what's wrong with this picture or what doesn't belong in this picture or something. And for them to get it correct, it was, they'd have to say the couch. Well, the bias reviewer was like, wait a minute, in some parts of the country, like where I grew up, it wasn't unusual to have a couch on the front porch. So that's not a good item for us to be asking or penalizing individuals for things like that. So
the bias reviews are obviously very important, but also remembering that we have successive waves of immigration that continuously come through. I look at my kids, they're third generation U.S. now. So if you think about that third generation versus, they're more acculturated now. They are very proficient in the language. But what about the new waves of students that are coming in that are new to the country as well? So there may be things on there that we take for granted that may be new to them or maybe that are not what they're used to in terms of cultural as well. So being very aware of that acculturation piece as well, I think is vitally important. Mm-hmm.
Very much so. Do you have any like stories or antidotes about the importance of bringing diversity into the creation of a test and beyond?
Sometimes we're in a binary, you know, kind of mindset that there's an L1 at home, there's an L2, you know, English. But some students are coming from a broader range than that. I did have about 2 years ago worked with a student that came from a home that there was three languages being spoken. The assumption was that this student was an English learner, but actually more than that, he was a Spanish learner as well. So we thought he was Spanish, but we really started probing in. His family came from a region of Mexico where they spoke Mixteco, right? So it's that third language variable that was brought into play. So we're coming in full force, adrenaline, you know, okay, we got to test the student, got to do all that, but not considering how that third factor came into place, his level of experience with his parents' language. So they were Spanish language learners as well. So how does that carry over into the testing? We had that third language variable now. He's a Spanish learner because he was in a dual immersion program. He was an English learner as well. Really taking the time to ask the questions of the family. Are there other languages being spoken? What about customs that are brought in terms of that piece of it as well? A lot of parents maybe just didn't want to share that piece of it. Maybe they didn't want to share. Maybe there's covering up of that piece as well. So I think really the moral to the lesson there is how important it is to talk to the family, get to know the family, do the rapport piece. I still do private practice, so it's always talking to the family, getting to know them and trying to ask the right questions. Sometimes we feel, well, we don't know this or we didn't know that, but sometimes we're not asking the right questions to get that information that would be very vital in our processes.
Talking about language and understanding the difference, the acquisition of language, et cetera, we hear a lot about BICS and CALP, so basic interpersonal communication skills versus cognitive academic language proficiency. Can you talk a little about each of those and highlight really what teachers should know when it comes to this, because those teachers a lot of times are the referrer of the student when they're being assessed for special education services. And I think it's really important that teachers be able to distinguish between what is BICS and what is CALP.
I think it's very important when we look at language, it's not binary, either or. It's a spectrum, right? So when you think about BICS, it's that social language, right? It's that language that we talk to when we are with our families in the living room or over the dinner table with our friends on the playground. So it's very social, right? It's interaction. You know, if I'm hanging out with my friends at a restaurant, I'm going to be most likely probably talking social, right? Socially, what's going on with the family and talking about my vacation and et cetera, right? But then when I'm in the classroom, say as a university student, I'm talking a whole other language, right? We're talking more technical, more academic, we're reading, we're writing. That would be that CALP piece, that cognitive academic language proficiency. And again, in working with the students that we work with, a lot of them are probably coming from homes where it's a BICS level L1. I think of myself and my family, we spoke Spanish and I was pretty fluent in the language. But if you were to ask me to speak or write in the language, it would be a lot different. You know, I wouldn't be able to necessarily talk about a book I read and really look at it from an academic standpoint because my language was social. All of our tests, right? Cognitive tests, academic tests, that's all academic CALP, right? It's all cognitive academic. It's a different level of demand that's required at that level of language. So more advanced cognitive academic language proficiency. And that's what usually our state level tests look at. In California, we have what's called the LPAC, the Access in other parts of the country. So there's different tests that are used and they're assessing CALP levels. And that CALP level is really that predictor, right, of what they can do academically in the classroom setting. So if you have a student that's at a certain CALP level, you know, you're going to say, okay, well, this is probably what we could expect from them in terms of academically to function in that language. So it's more advanced, it's more academic versus that social piece of language. And we made the mistake. Let me just rewind a little bit. When I started as a school psych, in order for me to determine which language to assess a student, and I would always talk, well, you know, let me ask you some questions. And I would talk to the student about how old they were and their family, what they did on the weekend, engage myself on, okay, well, they were able to communicate and answer my questions. So I'm able to give them a good academic test in English, you know, and I was looking at that social piece, that BICS piece. So again, really knowing the difference between the two is vitally important.
Right. And I think from the aspect of starting that assessment, the first thing you're going to look at is that language proficiency.
Yes, exactly. Now, we also want to remember is that BICS and CALP language develops, right? So it's a process. And there's different models. Some look at it from 4 levels, others 5, others 6, right? There's different levels of development. But I think the thing that we want to keep in mind is that kids that come from L1 homes are going to develop very differently. Sometimes we worry, well, that they're not developing quickly enough, right? We always say 7 years. That's our marker out there. But you have to look at that kids that come from L1 homes are going to develop very differently because of that factor I talked about earlier that when we're going home, we're speaking another language. We're not processing the English over and over and over to develop that. We're going back to our home language. So it could look a lot slower, right? Not because there's something inherently wrong, but because when we go home, we're not practicing it. We're not engaging in it to the degree of a kid that may be in a monolingual home, English home. So it's important for us to consider that piece of it. Sometimes we worry, well, they're not developing. They've been stuck in level 3 for so long. Well, let's evaluate how opportunities to speak together, to practice it, to engage in it. Like when my kids come home and we speak, we're able to talk about what they learned at school and process it and get into it. Not everyone has that opportunity to do that. So I think it's important for us to remember that piece of it.
So when you talked about 7 years, can you talk a little bit about, for those who aren't familiar with BICS and CALP? I know Jim Cummins did a lot of the work regarding BICS and CALP, but what are the timelines they say it takes to establish BICS and then to establish CALP?
Yeah. I think general rule of thumb, right, we look at to establish the BICS level, maybe about 3 years or so, right? So the first 3 years, you go through that silent period. You're developing, you know, level 2, level 3, right? When you look at from the BICS model, 5 is full fluency. And again, how do we define it? We're defining the verbal, writing, reading. It depends how we're defining it. But for you to get social language, about 3 years approximately. And again, to move on to full fluency, we're looking at about 7 years or so. But I always take a step back and say, you know, I think that we have to understand there's a lot of variability there, right? Again, when I look at opportunity for input and output, right? So input of the L2, output, opportunity to practice, it depends on your environment. A lot depends on your environment. You know, I'm hearing more and more now, well, it's newer term, long-term English learner, right? Kids that are now, they're in 9th, 10th, 11th grade. They're still considered English learners. And the way I see that is it depends on your environment. There's communities where you don't have to speak L2, right? You can speak your L1 the entire time, right? And family speaks L1. And maybe for the family, I know in our home, it was like you speak Spanish at home because our families wanted us to maintain that home language. How often do you go back to your home country and spend time over there? And so I think there's a lot of variables versus maybe you live in a community where you cannot speak your L1. And your parents maybe say, hey, you know, at home, we're going to speak English, right? We want you to develop English. And then also there's those psychological factors. You know, if I say a word in English and you laugh at me, most likely because I said it wrong, I'm probably not going to say it again. You know, so there's that psychological apprehension of willing to take the risk to learn that language to speak, because it's a risk you're taking. You know, I know that when I was younger and I would go to Mexico, visit family, and I said a word wrong over there, they laugh. I didn't want to say it again. So I withdrew because I didn't want to get laughed at. So there's a lot of those psychological factors as well. You mentioned teachers, right? And what should they know? I think make it really a safe environment for students to be able to use their L2 without shame, without embarrassment. So really work on that piece of it. I think the other piece is that relationship. So that student can feel safe, even in a one-on-one interpersonal level, talk to you as a teacher and feel really safe using that second language piece. I think it's important.
Right. Yeah, you know, what I've experienced too in the past involved like teachers not really understanding or being able to distinguish between Bix and Calp. So they would see the students engaging in, you know, conversation with their peers on the playground and in the lunchroom and things like that. And then the teacher's like, well, I don't understand. They can speak a language out there, but when it comes to doing academics, they're struggling. They must have a learning disability. So not understanding that, hey, this is a different type of language.
Are they speaking about video games? Are they speaking about the soccer game or football game? Or are they talking about the scientific method in their L1?
Yes.
It's a different level. It's very different. Most likely in the playground, you're speaking about the football game versus a scientific method or about Romeo and Juliet in Spanish, right? It's a different level of language demands that are required.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I agree. That needs to be something that needs to be front and center when we're preparing these teachers.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So we often hear people complaining that tests are language loaded and we shouldn't necessarily use these tests, etc. What are your thoughts on that?
I would say that it's hard to separate out language from these tests because what are we using the tests for? We're using them as predictors of academic learning at the end of the day, right? So if we're trying to predict academic learning, well, in education, what's the most important variable for success?
Language.
And that's the most important component. So it's hard to separate the two out, knowing that piece of it that I'm thinking about, as you said, that, you know, CHC abilities, crystallized intelligence, that's the biggest predictor, right? And some consider that as achievement. I see this kind of what's made it through. When you look at all the way we process information, the way it comes in, it's what's finally made it through and that we've been able to hold on to, whether it's vocabulary, words, all that is academic. So you can't separate the two. We have to be very cognizant of that. Being language loaded is something that's impossible to separate out because it's academics is language, is verbal abilities, comprehension, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
Knowing that, I think we go back to the discussion of Bix and Calps, right? And understanding what level of Calp does a student have, right? And is the level of Calp commensurate with the kid's academic abilities in the classroom, what the teacher's seeing, you know? And that's why I like, for example, the Woodcock-Johnson oral language. If I could just talk very quickly about it from that point of view, it's been so helpful because I'm able to see, okay, this student's CALP is at a certain level. And you could interpret and say, this is the level, these are the instructional implications, right? What does it mean in the classroom? And I think that's very helpful because if we can know where the kid's linguistic abilities are and we can see where their academics are, and we can see, okay, are they performing at that expected level given their capabilities, right? I think it's important to have that information in mind. It could help us on the path of, is it a difference or a disorder, knowing that information.
Right. I like that you mentioned the WJ, also the WMLS and the Batteria. They all give you the CALP scores, right? The CALP levels to help with guidance with regards to
So what I love saying about a tool like, say, the Woodcock Munoz, you look at it from, say, a Bloom's taxonomy standpoint, you know, you can get as deep as you want in the language piece. You want to say more vocabulary, more knowledge, or, okay, are they able to analyze it? Are they able to synthesize linguistic information? The test is going to be able to tell you that, how they would do on more higher order tasks in the classroom setting.
Right.
So if it's always, I think, a very good starting point. You know, I kind of advocate, I know in my environment, when I was a school psychologist, we usually used to sign the assessment plan. The kid was ready to be tested. Then we would give the Woodcock-Munoz or the BVAT at that time. But I think it's really important to have it maybe even before the testing process, more at the early stages, maybe even at the pre-referral process, because at that point, we're able to gauge better. Okay, maybe this kid, there's, you know, he has low CALP, his academics are maybe a little bit lower, and his CALP is also lower. Maybe we should give him more intervention or more English language development services. Maybe that's what's going on here, and we're able to see that.
Right.
So I think we need a lens like that when we're testing, a gauge, something to help us understand that piece of it. Because again, as you started the question right now, language is embedded in all this, right? Everything's language, you know, very difficult to separate ourselves out from that.
Which brings me to the point of, you know, language, and when we're thinking about specific learning disabilities, we have those specific exclusionary factors that we have to rule out as being that primary cause of student struggle. And language is one of those, right?
And I think, again, it goes back to looking then, as we're looking at exclusionary factors, understanding that what kind of educational program has a student been in, right? Are they in a dual immersion, bilingual program, SEI, level of supports? To access that interventions, have they had interventions that are linguistically appropriate? Because at the end of the day, when we're talking about language in the test, we're testing what they've learned. Do they know this?
Right.
And if they haven't had opportunity to learn that information, then obviously it wouldn't be a fair assessment. But we're really testing that piece of it. So being able to see the big picture is important.
Right. And this is not something I had planned on asking you, but you kind of brought it to my attention. Thinking about dynamic assessment and pulling in dynamic assessment techniques when you're testing these kiddos, can you talk a little bit about maybe an example of when you've done that with the child?
For example, and I know this would be going off standardization. When I do my reports, I have that column that says the standardized score, right? So you stick to the standardization.
Right.
Then I have the other column that I say non-standardized, kind of how I would report that out. But I did have, for example, students that come into mind, say the Woodcock-Johnson oral language, and some, they may have not known some items. So what I would do is I would give them the score, how they scored standardized, and then I would review it. Okay, this is what this is, you know, kind of share that information. I'm making it up now, but there's a pine tree here. You know, we're looking at an expressive vocabulary task. Well, this is a jet ski or whatever. And then make sure they understand what it is and maybe come back to it 2 days later and see, okay, you remember these things? What are they? If they were retaining that information, that's just one example of many.
Right.
I want to see, are they able to retain that information? Maybe they just didn't know what it was. So, okay, let's do the multiple choice, all right? Is this a bush? Is it a banana tree? Or is it something else? And then were they able to retain that information, right? So you kind of teach it to them and see, really tease out, is it a memory issue or a language issue? Or is it just lack of exposure? They've never seen that before.
Yeah, I've seen that a lot with like the analogies tests. Specifically, young kids just haven't been exposed to analogies. And we give that ECAD analogies test and they're like, what? What? Even with the sample items. So that's what I would do. I would go ahead and administer it and then score it that way. And then I'd go back and do some type of small lesson with them about analogies and then re-administer to see if they then understood. And a lot of them do after they have a little bit of instruction.
Because they just hadn't had the opportunity to learn how to do that. Another way I kind of look at it as well is doing, say, an auditory processing test. We do sound blending or blending sounds. Sometimes you wonder, are they not able to capture that word because maybe they've never heard that word and they're doubting themselves of what they heard? So maybe comparing blending known words to non-words, right, to see how they compare. Are they able to blend those sounds that they've never heard versus those that others have heard? Because we're comparing them to kids that already heard those words, right? So again, I like kind of doing that sound blending versus non-word sound blending and kind of comparing the two as well. I think it's also another way to approach that as well.
And as we're kind of talking along these lines of different techniques you can use to better understand these kiddos and tease out the language piece, we think about observations and how important testing observations are, but also your classroom observations. So when you go in like to the classroom to observe the child, what are some of the things that you're really looking for when it comes to specifically for a kiddo who might be EL or bilingual?
Yeah, I would think on the surface, a lot could look the same. Are they following along? Are they keeping up with the pace of the lecture, right? If the teacher's checking in for understanding, how do they respond? Are they behind in the lecture? Are they having difficulties understanding what's going on? The writing as well. How are they writing phonetically? Are they misspelling words, but does it sound phonetically right? I think a big piece of it is just how are they keeping up with the pace of the lecture? Do you check it in? What do they respond? So I do think there's a way to go to the classroom and observe that piece of it.
Yeah, I agree. Awesome. Okay, so kind of getting down to the last of our questions, but what I wanted to do, I didn't think it'd be appropriate for us to talk about this without talking about COVID and understanding the impact that COVID has had. I mean, we know across the board, I'm hearing it over and over when I'm talking to evaluators about these kiddos who are having flat profiles, like academically, they're low across the board and, you know, wanting to figure out how much of this is due to COVID, lack of education and things like that. From your experience, what impact did COVID have on the EL students?
I think the big piece is just, as we kind of been saying, lack of opportunity to practice in the classroom, you know, and engage, right? So first, let's talk about it from a language development standpoint, you know, not going to school, not interacting with peers, practicing the language, socially bix. If I don't speak Spanish for a long time, it gets harder to kind of get the words out. You know, my tongue gets tied. So without that practice, you're going to stop there, right? Opportunity for output. I think that's a big piece there. So I think a lot of it, those language proficiency scores may be impacted because of that opportunity to practice. Now you're at home, you're speaking L1 more. Academics as well. We did see students, again, not being able to develop that English vocabulary, which we know is so important for comprehension. And as we said earlier, language discussions, reading, writing, et cetera. So being there, listening to other students' ideas, the teacher giving you specific feedback was in many ways significantly impacted, right? Because students weren't going to school. There was a lot of technology issues. Then there was protocols where kids couldn't go to school if you had suspicions of COVID. So in our school, if you had COVID, you obviously weren't able to go to school. Secondly, you needed to have a doctor clear you. And even after the doctor cleared you, a week later, you had a retest again before you came back to school. They sent packets, but obviously it's not the same as being within the classroom setting. But I mean, those are just a few things, you know. Then you think about those that were economically impacted, not maybe they had to move in with other family members. So now they're in another school district. And we know that all the same level of technology. I know my kids' school, the teacher had a lot of problems with technology. So the parents were at home trying to follow along as well. So think about how fast the curriculum goes. If you miss a week, you're way behind. How easy is it to catch up? Even if you miss a week, now imagine several of that.
Right.
So there's just a lot of disruption that happened across the board. And I think we're seeing a lot of it now. Oh, there's so many kids I'm testing. You know, it's just kind of, it's just been overwhelming.
Right.
That just kind of triggered another thought. What about also those long COVID symptoms, right? So now, you know, you get over it, but now there's long COVID as well. So now kids aren't feeling the same anymore or thinking as they were before. So there's just these long lasting impacts that I think were created as well, not just because of the time loss, but also now neurologically and physically, we're feeling that. Teacher turnovers as well, right?
I know, that was a whole nother, that's a whole nother conversation.
And substitutes.
Shortage of teachers, not having certified teachers in the classroom now. What is that going to do for all of our kids? I know there was some research that was done where they were looking at long COVID and the effects that, like how does it manifest itself, like in children and things like that, and the neuropsychological piece of that. And a lot of those manifestations come across as like ADHD type symptoms, that fogginess, that issue with long-term memory or short-term memory and things like that.
Processing speed as well, right? Yeah, mental organ, executive of the organization, the ability to plan ahead, right? I can see the initiation, you know, the motivation to do the work. You see a lot of
that. And then I was thinking too about these kids with long-term effects of COVID. By the end of the day, you're worn out, you know, after when you have COVID and then your body's kind of building back up. It's like you get worn out by the end of the day. You're ready for a nap and things like that. So that could come across as some attentional issues too.
Exactly. So. Yeah. A lot of times we talk about screen time. How much screen time is appropriate? Kids were on the screen the entire day, either through iPads, computers, right? So what does that do as well? You know, you're not moving around, you're just sitting down, right? So it's just a lot to unpack. Probably 10 years from now, we're going to obviously know a lot more of this impact, but look at it from a school psych standpoint, definitely a lot of impact.
Yes, there. For sure. What are some of the things that you might recommend for educators to do to help fill in the gap in English language proficiency that was caused by COVID?
Yeah. Number one is just that understanding. I think as educators, really being aware of just the impact of COVID, right? And what that, how that manifests, not only academically, but the mood state of children, families. So really being aware of all that, I think is important. And I think it's true for all students, that relationship piece with students as well, right? Really working on that relationship piece. You know, I think foundational to learning, a lot of vulnerabilities out there, maybe economic issues, families that go through. So that relationship, I think, is very important. Also welcoming students into the classroom, celebrating their culture, their language. More on the academic side, I think, you know, we hear a lot all the time about that progress monitoring. Right. You're really monitoring your students to see how they're doing, right? Are they progressing? Are they, you know, are they saying, you know, stable, or are they going down, right? So that progress monitoring is super important. Also advocating for interventions at the classroom setting. And just overall, I do think that it's also important to really be in touch with your mental health professionals, your school psychologists, school counselors, and school social workers, I think is vital as well, amongst many other things. But I think those are the big ones right there that we really got to keep in mind.
Yeah, there's so much to consider. And you've talked a little bit about like the WJ oral language. We mentioned the WMLS. Are those the main linguistic tools that you use as part of your assessment, or do you have other ones?
Yeah. There's one that's free. I always say, hey, you could just download for free. It's called the Solo, which is one that's more of an alingual one. So that one could be used with multiple languages. I think the Solom is a good one to give because it's interview format. It's free, and it gives you also an estimate of count in that home language as well. But again, what I do find very helpful about the Wood College Johnson oral language or the Munoz is that that's very, I think, super valuable is that English Cal piece and just how, what is it? What are the educational implications? So I think that's the big piece there that's very helpful. And again, helps us with that difference of disorder piece.
Thinking about teachers or parents who, let's say teachers who have students who are new to the country, you know, we're talking about the immigrants and things like that, or parents who are brand new, have just come over to the country and stuff. What recommendations would you give either the parents or the teachers or both, who are thinking about referring a child for SLD with that type of background? What recommendations might you give?
Number one, I think it's, and I'll go back to the state that I talked about earlier, is that relationship piece. I think it's important to really have that relationship with the parents. And if parents are concerned about it, to really, you know, get to know what their concerns are, right? And to really kind of develop that piece of it. The other piece is a lot of parents don't know what special ed is, right? They may not even know what that means. A lot of times, I've been at meetings where it's kind of sold as, okay, it's just help, it's help, it's tutoring, you know, and to a certain degree, there's an element of that, but really understanding what special education is. And I'm not saying it's bad, I'm not saying that at all, but really understanding the big picture of what special education means. A lot of times I know parents that I've worked with, so, well, maybe that may just help them learn English better, but to understand that's geared towards children that have disabilities. So I think it's important to for parents to have that information of exactly what it is. Teachers also, I've been in IEP meetings where I know teachers also see it as a source of help. Right? Oh, we want to give the kid help because they're behind. So really understanding that piece of it, but also there's other maybe interventions that we can do that can help your kid access those academic skills, right? So I think it's just providing information and not rushing to say, oh, there's a disability right away. I know there's certain districts, well, we're going to wait 3 or 4 years. You know, there's always this time limit. I'm not a believer in that because every case is unique and individual. But when we're talking about SLD, I do think that we got to really educate in terms for parents what special education is. Also educate them on the developmental process, that there's a process that we have to develop and let them know that it is a language acquisition process as well. So I think that those are variables we need to consider before rushing to special education and providing that. So really having that information of what special education is and how to provide what the implications are, you know, down the line with that.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Overa, for joining us today. Really appreciate you having this conversation with us. It's really important for evaluators, teachers, parents, all be aware of the importance of really looking at those different variables when assessing a child, but especially a child who's an English learner or a diverse learner. Again, I want to thank you for being here. Really appreciate it. Thank you for everything you do in the field to help serve these kiddos too. So, any last thoughts?
Thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I really am very, very grateful. And Just one last thought, I think also that just kind of close off with is that I know we use the term English learner a mm-hmm. lot, but really these are bilingual students, right? My big aha moment was really realizing that, you know, a lot of times we focus on the limited English, right? But also not looking at, a lot of them come with the home language and they're really bilingual students. So really celebrating the fact that, you know, we are dealing with kids that are bilingual and to be able to nurture that and to really educate ourselves on that bilingual development. They're coming with different experiences and they're not going to progress like students who come from monolingual backgrounds. You know, we really want to celebrate that they're learning two languages and looking at it from that standpoint. And whenever I use that narrative, it seems like it changes the tone of the meeting, right? The fact that they're even here at this level is impressive, you know, because again, who are we comparing them to? So I think it's just important to keep that piece in mind.
I agree with that. Thank you for sharing. That's so true. I mean, what a great thing to be able to speak two languages. I wish I could speak two languages. Yeah. Well, thank you again. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Enriching Education, brought to you by Riverside Insights. For more on how you can enrich the lives of students, visit us at riversideinsights.com.